It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we continue our ongoing series about the impacts of the Great Recession. Today, we'll take a closer look at the places in the U.S. that had the speediest recoveries from the downturn and talk about lessons we can learn from them. First, when we talk about our favorite eras of music, we often divide things up into decades, your 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on. With our current decade wrapping up in less than 3 months, depending on how you define it, we figured it'd be a good time to think about how we'll remember the music of the 2010s. Our next guest says the growing influence of hip-hop, retro party music, and the dominance of women on the pop charts are just a few of the trends that characterize the last 10 years. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. He's here in the studio. Alexander, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Before we dive into the music, is it hard to talk about music given that there are so many genres and subgenres and we don't even have a common language about it?
It is. I mean, one of the glories of the current world that we are in is that there is so much music to choose from. But the flip side of it is that it is very hard to chart or follow all of it. In an earlier era, music historians or music critics really had the opportunity to learn everything that kind of really mattered. You know, like there were maybe 500 albums a year that really mattered and they could hear them all. And not only that, but a lot of other people couldn't hear them all. And so you had a kind of expertise that doesn't exist in quite the same way today, but we will give it a shot anyway.
That said, yeah, you have pointed out some trends over the last 10 years. And one of those trends is women at the top of the pop charts. Beyonce, Adele, Taylor Swift, Lady Gaga, Rihanna, just to name a few. What made this such a big decade for women in the pop world?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I think on the one hand, it's just an acknowledgement of an audience and artists who were always there before but never received the kind of recognition that they really deserved. A music industry that finally sort of understood that their audience, at least the core audience that drove pop hits, were primarily young women in particular. And that now you had an audience that wanted to hear female voices and finally a recognition that that could actually happen. So I think that that's part of the process that we have seen. And also just a lot of women who are creating music that plays into a lot of the predominant trends of the moment, the way in which hip-hop and R&B merged together, the way in which country and pop came together, as it has many times in the past, but in a new way in the present, the rise of dance music. I think all of those genres have been genres that women in particular have taken the lead in creating really vibrant new music.
Well, women, and you mentioned hip-hop, I want to give a listen to a breakthrough, one of the few hip-hop hits by a female rapper, Cardi B, Bodak Yellow. Here's a short listen. Now she say she gon' do what or who? Let's find out and see. Cardi B, you know where I'm at, you know where I be. You in the club just to party, I'm there, I get paid a fee. I be in and out them dance so much. Cardi B there. Can you talk about how hip-hop has been influential, though not always number one pop hit influential?
So hip-hop, in terms of its beats, in terms of the tone and the style of hip-hop, has really come to dominate pop music. The mode of performing through those hip-hop sounds really has infiltrated every form of music, whether it's pop music at the very top of the charts, whether it's country music. If you put country music on today, a lot of the records have a kind of hip-hop tone to them. Whether it's R&B and the way in which hip-hop and R&B are at times almost interchangeable, hip-hop has really become the dominant sound of youth culture and really was that for a while. But it's only, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years that has really gained a kind of chart dominance in that way as well. When I talk about the music not quite hitting the top of the charts, one thing I noted is I went through for this looking at the sort of top 100 hits of the last decade, is that there are a lot of songs that are influenced by hip-hop at the top of the charts, but not a lot of hip-hop artists per se who have quite hit the top of the pop charts. So there are limits to hip-hop's reach when it comes to reaching a crossover audience, an audience that maybe wants to hear some of the sound of hip-hop but isn't necessarily all that interested in hearing the artists themselves.
And before we move on from hip-hop, I don't think we can talk about the last 10 years without mentioning Kendrick Lamar, just a huge dominant figure, not only his own albums, but being attached to one of the biggest movies of the decade, Black Panther, and doing the soundtrack to that. Can you talk about him and the influence he's had?
Well, I think Kendrick Lamar's influence has been profound. He is an artist, really along with Beyonce, who has who has had the capacity to create meaningful art that has also been part of a social movement, in this case, the movement of African Americans to fight for their own freedoms and for their own rights, in a way that has also been popular, that has also been pop music. And that is not always an easy trick to pull off, particularly in this day and age where a lot of big record labels want the music to be as universal as possible so that it can get the gain the greatest global audience. So what he has really done is to do both of them at the same time. And in doing so has also really brought together contemporary listeners, young listeners who really like what he is doing, who feel that he's doing really contemporary new music. And yet at the same time, building on some of the traditions of hip hop from the 1990s and even the 1980s, the sort of emphasis on skills on the mic, a way in which he engages in a lot of storytelling. And so I think he's brought multiple generations of hip hop fans together. And I think that's also part of the reason why he has been so successful.
We're taking a tour of the music of the 2010s. Alexander Shashko is with us from UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there an artist you've been following over the last 10-ish years? Tell us about it. Who do you like? Are you staying on top of some element of current music? It's hard to follow all of it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to turn to Latin music now, getting into the charts. Despacito, a song that you couldn't not hear, it seemed like,
absolutely,
for a while there. Luis Fonsi, Justin Bieber joined in on a remix, billions of views on YouTube. Here's a little listen. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito, deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito, quiero desnudarte a besos despacito, firmo en las paredes de tu laberinto. Pretty catchy song. What made it such a phenomenon?
It's a very catchy song. I think that's the main reason. I think when it comes right down to it, when a song is a hit, it's because it's catchy and everything else follows after that. So that is clearly the main reason. But I also think the timing is important. I think as the decade has gone on, there has been a greater recognition of Latin music globally and in the United States, and it has risen in popularity. I think one of the things that made Despacito so successful is that it is a mostly Spanish language song that made it on the conventional top 40 charts, and that is pretty unusual. Usually there has to be more English language on it than there was on that. And I think that's really representative of the way in which we live in a more multicultural society, but also in a global society where there's a massive audience for Latin music and where people are listening to to music online and hence are listening to what people are doing everywhere around the world instantaneously.
And you mentioned there being a hip-hop influence on a lot of pop songs, even if it's not a hip-hop song or artist. Same thing with Latin music, do you think?
Absolutely. The call and response between hip-hop and Latin music has been profound from the very beginning. You have to remember that in the Bronx in the 1970s, it wasn't just African-Americans and R&B and funk music that those early MCs and DJs were playing. It was also the salsa coming out of Fania Records. It was a boogaloo music. There was a lot of Latin music that was there from the very start. And ever since, there has been a conversation going on between the Latin world and the hip-hop world with beats, with styles. And this is just a new manifestation of that happening.
Now, zooming out from particular songs for a minute, our producer talked to you before you came on with this, and you said you see a lot of songs in the last 10 years. This is interesting. Speaking to feelings of anxiety or terror. Spell that out for us.
Well, we live in very difficult times in certain ways. And for a younger generation in particular, they are looking around at a political and a social situation that is fraught with uncertainty, whether it was 9/11, which is, of course, a decade before the period we're talking about, but which is the effects of which we still feel today, whether it was the economic collapse of 2008, and so on. They have lived with a certain kind of economic and social anxiety, which has played out in the music. A lot of the music of the last decade has been very intentionally comforting. It has been music that sounds very relaxing in a way, and that is in part because people want that sense of relaxation in the music itself. And so I think that that's an important part of the overall trend that we see going on in almost every genre of music.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mick is with us in Milwaukee. Mick, hi.
Hey there.
What'd you want to bring up, Mick?
I had a question for Professor Shashko. I wanted to ask about what his take on soul music and blues and gospel kind of making its second coming into rap. You know, you got people like Thundercat and Chance the Rapper, you know, releasing big albums, and a lot of people are gravitating more towards that soul rap. I wanted to ask his opinion on that.
It's a great question. I do think there has been something of a jazz revival that we hear going on. Now, people talk about that a lot, almost all the time. I'm not saying that jazz is suddenly going to show up on the top of the charts. That's not going to happen. But we have heard with Kendrick Lamar, with Thundercat, with others, a real effort to integrate jazz into the world of hip-hop on pop records, not just on sort of records that are intentionally meant to be for a jazz audience. And I think that that is a welcome part of the diversity of the music space that we're in, where there's room for something like that. And similarly, with Chance the Rapper and others, we hear a lot of gospel influence and a lot of soul influence. Again, nothing new. I mean, the early DJs and MCs were filled with, you know, all their records were James Brown records and Parliament Funkadelic records. I mean, that's not really new. But I think it's more the sentiment behind those sounds that we hear infused at this current moment. Some of these records being about hope and particularly the gospel-tinged ones, the jazz records being about kind of reimagining what the world can be at a time when people are grasping for that. And so I think that those movements are really part of the broader way in which society is trying to figure things out at this time.
Mick, thanks for that call. We're talking to Alexander Shashko, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, looking at some of the biggest trends in music over the last decade. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What among the what in the world of new music are you listening to? What do you follow? Or is it all an alien landscape to you? Do you stick with the comfort music from your own decade, whatever that might be? Do you have a question for a guest about the trends he's seen over the last 10 years, the ones you've seen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our talk with Alexander Shashko, lecturer in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. We're talking about the 2010s in popular music. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the music of the 2010s is going to be remembered? Who are your favorite songs or artists, or what's the genre you've been checking out the new music in for the last 10 years or so? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Joe is with us in New Lisbon. Joe, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Joe?
So I wanted to ask what you thought the impact of metal music or heavier rock has brought to the genre of music.
Joe, thanks for the call. I'm not like a heavy metal guy, but I do miss, you know, loud guitars in my pop music these days, I feel like.
So it's true that metal is not really part of the top 40 landscape the way that it was in the past. But the one thing about metal that's really interesting is just how popular it has remained. It is an incredibly durable genre in terms of its audience, in terms of the sort of stability of it as a genre of music. And even though it isn't sort of at the vanguard of what is happening on the pop charts, it has really benefited from, I think, globalization. It has really benefited from a kind of global audience of metal listeners and artists who can sort of band together from one region to another. Those bands can really tour all the way around the world, and they can continue to be heard. In a lot of ways, we really undervalue where they stand within the broader universe of pop music because they haven't been directly connected with some of the newest movements. But the movement continues to be there. And I do think that the music really reflects both an interest in craft, because I think that metal is often very much about the musical craft of how to compose a song and how to perform it. And also, it reflects that sense of anxiety that I was talking about, that sense of the world being on the precipice at times and wanting to make sense of it in some way.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Another trend you cued us in on is a retro feel to a lot of music. Let's listen to one example. This is going back to 2013. Was it that long ago? Get Lucky by Daft Punk. So let's raise the bar and our cups to And I hear this, you know, this could be a disco song, right? You hear Uptown Funk. That could be Morris Day and the Time or any number of bands. Sometimes I hear songs like, is this a Depeche Mode track I missed in the 80s? There's a lot of kind of throwback music.
There is. That song in particular, Get Lucky, is not only an homage to Nile Rodgers of the criminally underappreciated band Chic. Nile Rodgers is actually on the record. He's the one playing the guitar on it. So it's really representative of trying to connect the past and present. You know, I think one thing that has happened is that in this world of streaming and in this world of digital media, in a sense, time has been really compressed, that you can now listen to music from any time period you want, and a lot of people do. So they're mixing and merging a lot of these old sounds. They have excitement for hearing some of those old sounds, even in the present. And so you get that kind of retro feel in a lot of the songs. It's also how you expand your audience. You know, if you want to reach not just the youngest generation, but an older generation at the same time, you put in music that they can relate to, and that's what Bruno Mars does. It's certainly what Adele does, right? I mean, those songs are very self-consciously hearkening back to the 1960s at the very least, and so that movement has been one that has often ended up at the very top of the charts.
Let's bring on another caller now. Etta is with us in Viroqua. Etta, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Etta? What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just joined the conversation, but and I know that you guys had already talked about women, but I thought Lizzo and Janelle Monáe both need to be mentioned by name because they're amazing.
Etta, thanks so much for the call. Lizzo is just all over the place these days. Janelle Monáe, like one of those like rare musical geniuses that I don't know how to categorize her.
I listen, they're both terrific. I think that they are both artists that have captured something of the tradition of Afrofuturism, which is an intellectual and artistic tradition in which African Americans not just write about their past or present, but also imagine what their future might be. That's more Janelle Monáe than Lizzo, but both of them work within that realm to an extent. And I think that that has been really invigorating for people, especially because I think what they both share is a sense of individuality and of expressing that individuality, that they don't necessarily feel like they have to completely be on trend the way that many artists do. There's an independent streak there that at least is articulated in the music, if not actually in the music itself. And so I think they both kind of share that spirit, and I think a lot of people have been excited about hearing their music as a result.
Etta, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're looking at some of the big trends in music in the 2010s. Alexander Shashko is with us from UW-Madison. It's still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Let's talk a little bit about how we get our music and how that influences it. You mentioned that heavy metal can find this international audience, partly maybe because of streaming?
Absolutely. I mean, Spotify shows up in the United States, I think, around 2012 or so, and streaming has really transformed both the music industry and the way that people listen to music. I mean, it's weird actually to be talking about the decade in music and already putting downloading in the past, but here we are. Downloading very quickly became antiquated as streaming set in. It's something that actually the music labels have been thrilled about because it gives them a steady stream, so to speak, of income in a way that downloading did not, especially because there was so much illegal downloading that was part of it as well. As for the audiences, it has created a very convenient way to have a universal jukebox or something close to a universal jukebox. And it means that it doesn't matter what form or style of music you like, you can hear it whenever you want.
Let's go back to our callers. Mac is with us in Superior. Mac, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mac?
I just want to talk about, you touched on like slow, sleepy, you know, mental health related music. And I'm just excited about the second or third revitalization of the emo genre. A lot of really good stuff coming out from new bands, especially in the Midwest, like Tiny Moving Parts. We got Retirement Party. And I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. Do you think that we're seeing more of it in pop music because of the current state of the world?
I absolutely think we're hearing more of it because of the current state of the world, not just the emo revival in terms of the bands that you're talking about, but the way in which emo and that sort of very emotional sort of indie music has merged with hip hop. That what we've heard in a lot of the hip hop of the last 2 or 3 years is music that is deeply influenced by that emo movement, a real sense of vulnerability in the music. And I think that that has been, in general, healthy for the music, because what it has meant is a kind of expansion of the definition of masculinity within both hip hop and rock, where you can allow for men to display their vulnerability through the music. And I think that's been a really healthy progression that emo has been part of.
Well, let's check out another sensation that we probably shouldn't miss. Old Town Road by Lil Nas X. I think this is the version with Billy Ray Cyrus, longest running number one single ever, I think, as of earlier this year. Here's a listen. It's country music. It's a hip hop beat. It came out of what? Social media originally, right?
It did.
What?
First of all, everyone in here was bopping their heads as soon as it came on, even after it's been number one for, even after it was number one for 19 weeks. So that speaks right there to the hook itself. Yeah, this is a record that I think puts on full display the glory of American music, in the sense that it is about different genres of music, different people, different traditions all coming together and being mixed in new and interesting ways. I mean, it's very clear from what he has said that Lil Nas X is a country music fan, among other things, but he also defines himself as hip hop. The record really could be described as country music in practically every way. In terms of the lyrics, it's almost old-fashioned for modern country music.
A horse? But,
yeah, not exactly. But not a lot of that going on country radio. But sonically, it fits right in on country radio. And part of the reason for the controversy about its omission from the Billboard charts, Billboard decided it wasn't a country song, is that there's really no justification for it. You know, when you look at that, what happened, I think what you can't help but conclude is first of all, is it about a self-proclaimed hip-hop artist saying they want to be country and some of the racial implications of that? But also that Nashville can be a very insular place sometimes, and they don't want to put songs on the charts that aren't created in Nashville itself. And this is an interloper. But for Lil Nas X, it turned out to be a pretty great deal because he got Billy Ray Cyrus to do a remix, and it became the biggest selling pop song of all time. I think it speaks, too, to the fact that when you hear people say, I listen to everything now that they can stream music, I mean, that's not really true. When you really dig down, people don't listen to everything, but they're willing to listen to some different things. And I think that the fact that country and hip hop have kind of come together at this moment through that song is representative of that trend.
Alexander, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the 2010s in music. Still time to share your thoughts and favorites on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk about the idea of economic resiliency after big downturns like the Great Recession. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald is the latest to throw his hat into the congressional ring, announcing a bid today to succeed retiring U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner. We'll look at who's in and out in the various races for Congress here in the state. First, we continue our series on the impacts of and lessons from the Great Recession. Last week, we talked about how people approached personal finance before and after the recession and what's changed in consumer protections and banking and finance. Today, we look at the places in the country that rebounded faster than most after the recession and what we can learn from them about how local and regional economies can be more resilient in the face of future economic shocks. Stefan Getz is a professor of agricultural and regional economics at Penn State University and the director of the Northeast Regional Center for Rural Development. Stefan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We'll start, if you will, by defining what we mean by economic resilience.
Okay, so resilience in general is the ability to bounce back from a shock or from some kind of compression, say. In the case of economics, we usually look at it in terms of rebounding, whether it's employment growth or whether it's income. So if a shock occurs and the economy falls into a recession, let's say you lose jobs, people lose income, and then the resilience would measure how quickly the economy rebounds.
And when you look at the United States, and a lot of your research has kind of broken it down county by county, one size does not fit all. Some counties were very different when it came to resilience than others, right?
That's correct. So some of these factors that predict resilience can be controlled or changed by the county, others cannot. So some of those that can be controlled or influenced to some extent is the share of the population that has a college degree, for example, the share of the population that's the workforce that's 25 to 44 years old. labor force participation to the extent that an economy is more successful in bringing people into the workforce. That's a positive predictor, as is sort of industry diversity. So the more diverse the industry is, the more resilient the community, and that makes sense on an intuitive level. It's also business density makes a difference. So anything a community can do about self-employment, entrepreneurship, etc., is an important predictor.
Let's dig into some of those particulars now, and let's start with that business diversity, because you could have communities, with a lot of different kind of businesses, or think of a Detroit-style economy where for a long time it was car manufacturers and the industries that supplied them, or there might be places where there's that one factory, whether it's the paper mill or whatever it might be. Can you talk about how those different kinds of economies worked when it came to first suffering from the economic shock and then bouncing back from it?
Yeah, and that Detroit is a good example, actually, because we always think of it as just the heart of the auto economy traditionally, and it wasn't very diversified. So if you have all your eggs in one basket, let's say, and that particular sector is especially hard hit by the recession, then, of course, you're going to suffer more than an economy that's more diversified. So if housing construction is an important part of your economy, then obviously in the Great Recession, when a lot of mortgages went belly up, you were particularly hard hit. If, on the other hand, you were diversified, say, into software development, or you had other kinds of services, other kinds of light manufacturing, technology sectors, then those kind of communities would not have been impacted as severely. So the greater the diversity, the more resilient really these communities have been.
Now, how much control, if I'm, say, in county government or city government or something like that, how much control do I have in trying to say, okay, we are too reliant on this one kind of business, how do we mix things up?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we don't dictate what particular businesses should be in a community. But there are opportunities for pursuing sort of what we call targeted industrial recruitment. So if you know there's suppose you're buying a lot of goods from one particular sector, then from that's outside the county, then it might make sense to try and entice those kinds of businesses to come into your community to start supplying those services locally. But there are two other examples that also showed up in our model, and one of them is farming, which counties that were more had a relatively higher share of employment in farming were also more resilient. Whereas those that were more had a higher concentration of coal mining jobs were less resilient. And if you think about it, that makes sense. And in part, the energy sector takes a beating in a recession more so than other sectors as people cut back on energy consumption. But we still have to eat. So if you have more of a farming and agricultural sector or economy locally, then that also contributes to resilience.
Now, is it hard to tease out long-term factors like coal? We see things like cheaper natural gas hurting the coal industry, turning to alternative energies as well. Is it easy to sort out the impact of the recession itself versus these longer-term energy trends?
Well, yeah, that's you do see the blips in the lines. I mean, you see a long-term decline in coal mining employment, for example, right? But then when the Great Recession hits, you see an additional plunge, let's say, in this case. So we can sort out some of these longer-term and shorter-term impacts. And while, since you mentioned long and short-term, the other thing we found in some of our studies is that communities with more entrepreneurs or more self-employed workers are also more resilient. And we think it's because they're more nimble. They can change. They can change their product offerings. They can move into new kinds of services if a recession hits. So again, that's part of the story, that the more diversity you have, both in terms of different types of industries, but also in terms of self-employed workers, entrepreneurs, the more robust your community will be.
Talking to Stefan Getz, professor of agricultural and regional economics at Penn State University. He's the author or co-author of a number of reports on resilience, the way that communities around the United States bounce back or not from a big economic shock. Think of the Great Recession, for example. Stefan, in one of your papers, there was something that kind of surprised me as a factor here, a community's openness to immigrants and foreign-born residents as part of their resilience. How does that play out?
Yes, we were also a bit surprised by that. So we looked at the different, what we're calling connectivity of counties, the extent to which they're open to bringing in newcomers, whether they're foreign-born or not, whether they're migrants, domestic migrants from the U.S. And that, indeed, has quite consistently been a fairly strong predictor of a positive resilience. So the more open a community is to outsiders, to ideas, exchanges, flows of ideas, and so forth, the more robust it is. And we've seen that in other work, that communities that are welcoming, that capitalize on their natural assets, for example, and their resources, that build a good infrastructure that attracts people, places that are good for raising kids, for example, those communities tend to do well in terms of being more vibrant over the long run.
Another fact you looked at, and you touched on this briefly earlier, is the age of the workforce. What's the sweet spot? What helps a community bounce back from a recession when it comes to the age of its workforce?
Yeah, so there's some nuanced factors there. It's not quite so straightforward. It depends on what's happening in surrounding counties as well. But in general, we think that if you have a younger workforce, you have a less robust, resilient community or economy. And we think what's happening is there that these younger workers have less experience adapting to changes. If you have a more mature, more seasoned workforce, say those who are 45 and above, those workers have seen more shocks in their lifetimes. They've experienced declines, depressions. They may be more adaptable. So we didn't know going into this what the effect would be. A younger workforce might be more resilient on the one hand, but on the other hand, it seems like you have a more mature workforce. It's more maybe more experienced, and it seems to be better able to adjust to these kinds of downturns.
That said, that would be a hard thing for a community to put its thumb on the scale and change the age of its residents.
It would be, but, you know, again, a lot of people are looking for places that are ideal for raising kids, and, you know, this is sort of the age cohort where people have young children, they're trying to decide where to live. If they're not particularly bound to a big city, then they, they might move into a rural community, a smaller community, and change the scale, as you put it. But that also requires that the community has broadband access, you know, so that people can work and have the kinds of access to the kinds of services that they're used to. So it's a whole package of things that happen, but you can make communities more livable, and there are also strategies for pursuing particular age cohorts.
Now, there are different kinds of economic shocks, and we only have data from the ones that have actually happened, things like the bank collapse and the Great Recession, the economic downturn after the 9/11 attacks, things like that. Does it matter what the cause of the economic shock is to a community's getting knocked down and then bouncing back up?
Well, there's some emerging research on that. We've also looked at, for example, hurricanes and flooding events. And there, for example, we found long-lasting effects of opioid addiction, for example, which really surprised us. But the more traumatic the shock, and you can imagine, your house being flooded, that's more immediate than, say, there being a general decline in your economic decline in your community if you're not affected yourself. So these do seem to play out differently. I mean, if you lose your home, that's probably, and your job, say, that's going to be more traumatic than just losing your job, well, traumatic as that also is. So the different shocks do have different consequences, we think, both in the short term and the long term. But this is sort of an evolving research area.
What are some of the take-home lessons you hope that policymakers will get looking at your research?
Well, I think generally, and these are some of the recommendations we've made, is in investing in education, technology, infrastructure, and broadband, those kinds of things. We hear them quite a bit, but they do seem to make a difference in terms of long-term resilience. And another one would be creating communities where people want to live. I already talked about that, right? So mm-hmm. it's a balance of providing the goods and services that people want, the public goods, I mean. Another one would be growing youth engagement, involving the youth and developing the next generation of leadership in the community, because communities have to do this from within themselves, from within. They can't rely on outsiders to come in and tell them what to do. Another one is to diversify your economic development strategy. In other words, don't just focus on one particular industry. Diversify and also develop value chains. So, for example, that you develop markets locally, whether it's for farm products, whether it's for other goods and services that the community provides. And then maybe at some level the most important one, because it's quite tangible, is sort of to cultivate entrepreneurs and develop resources for business startups. All these things seem to make a positive difference.
Stefan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Stefan Getz, Professor of Agricultural and Regional Economics at Penn State University and Director of the Northeast Regional Center for Rural Development. He was with us today to talk about what makes a local economy more resilient and how towns and counties and other local governments could get ready for the next economic shock. Coming up, we'll get you up to speed on who's entering Wisconsin's congressional races, who's thinking about it, and who's out. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says the lines between politics and popular fan culture are getting hazy, and that may not be a good thing. First, Wisconsin's 2020 congressional races are starting to shape up. State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald announced his bid for the 5th District today. That's the seat currently held by longtime Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner in southeastern Wisconsin. Sensenbrenner has announced that he's not going to seek re-election next year. Also last week, Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany kicked off his candidacy for the 7th District in northwestern Wisconsin. That's currently held by Republican Sean Duffy. Only for a few more days, he announced his plans to resign back in August. A special election's coming up there. Other candidates have declared their intentions to get in and in some cases to opt out of these and other congressional races. Others still making up their minds. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the seat currently held by Representative Sensenbrenner. A big announcement, a prominent figure in Wisconsin politics, Scott Fitzgerald, saying he is running. You covered his announcement. What did he say about why he is seeking this office?
So he rolled out a line that we've actually become, I think, pretty familiar with from a number of campaigns in Wisconsin over the past several years. He said he wants to take Wisconsin values to Washington, D.C. I remember Congressman Brian Stile, who's a representative in the 1st District, now using that phrase quite a bit as well in his election campaign. Fitzgerald is really kind of pointing to his accomplishments as a Senate Majority Leader. He took that role in 2011, sort of saying, you know, this is what we accomplished in Wisconsin. These are the concrete conservative reforms I was able to push through in a leadership role. And that's the kind of thing I want to take to Washington, D.C.
Now, he's in the race. Last week, former State Senator Leah Vukmir, who had run for a Senate, U.S. Senate, said last week she is not running. What other names are still bouncing around out there on the Republican side, Laurel?
So there are still several people considering bids for this particular seat. This is a really kind of deep bench for Republicans, this part of the state. So some names folks might be familiar with. Former U.S. Senate candidate Kevin Nicholson says he's still thinking about the bid. He lost the Republican Senate primary to Leah Vukmir in 2016. Vukmir, of course, went on to running, or 2018 rather, against Senator Tammy Baldwin. Other folks still thinking about getting in the race, State Senator Chris Kapinga, another member of the state Senate, so he could be running against his colleague, Senator Fitzgerald, potentially. State Representative Adam Nealon is considering getting in the race, a GOP aide for Senator Ron Johnson, Ben Vogel, says he is weighing the bid. And then, interestingly, two sons of very prominent Republican politicians in Wisconsin are still thinking about it. Son of former Governor Scott Walker, Matt Walker, is thinking about getting in the race. And then son of former Wisconsin Congressman Mark Newman, Matt Newman, is thinking about getting in the race as well. So we could have another Walker-Newman race just a generation removed.
And it's not too surprising that there's a lot of possibilities out there because Representative Sensenbrenner has been there a long time. If you were a Republican in that district, you were kind of in don't-hold-your-breath mode if you wanted to end up in Congress.
Absolutely. I think this is something that people have been looking for quite a while. You know, Congressman Sensenbrenner has been in office for more than 40 years. People, I think, perhaps rightfully so, as the congressman has been getting on in years a little bit, thinking about when he might be interested in retiring and stepping down and when that seat might be available to them. People kind of keeping that on the back burner in terms of next steps in their political careers. And I think in addition to that kind of lead up to the seat being available, it is a really kind of stronghold for Republicans in Wisconsin. This particular region of the state has a lot of really high-profile Republicans that are in the queue for this race. Like I said before, it's kind of a deep bench for this part of the state.
Yeah, Republican stronghold. Do we have Democrats lining up here?
So there is one Democrat that has already announced his bid. He actually ran against Sensenbrenner in the last election. I believe got around 35% of the vote in that race, Tom Peltzowitz. So we already do have a Democrat in the race. This isn't a seat that I think Democrats are particularly optimistic about flipping just because of the incredibly strong conservative foundations of this particular district. It's those WOW counties, you know, that area of suburban Milwaukee that we often talk about being very strongly conservative. But, of course, it is, a presidential election year, high turnout, all sorts of different factors can go into these races. So we'll keep keeping an eye on it for sure.
Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, previewing some upcoming congressional races. Let's move to the 7th District. Sean Duffy, currently there, out pretty soon. He surprised a lot of people, I think, when he said he was leaving because of family health concern. There's supposed to be a special election, Laurel. Unless I've missed it, we don't know when that's going to happen, right?
That's right. So actually, Governor Tony Evers can't call that special election until Congressman Duffy officially steps down, which is on the 23rd. So we will hear from Governor Evers at some point on or after the 23rd. He's not allowed by state law to call that special election anytime before then.
Well, people are allowed to announce that they're running. Who do we have on the Republican side hoping to replace Sean Duffy?
So we have Senator Tom Tiffany. I think he's considered by Republicans to be a pretty strong front runner in that race. He's been a state senator from that district for quite a while. Has a good, kind of stronghold or strong footing, rather, of name recognition in the district. Being a state senator, he's represented a fairly sizable chunk of this district, though it is a huge district in northern Wisconsin. So Tiffany, I think, is somebody that has the potential of clearing out the Republican field a little bit on that side of things.
And how about Democrats? This lot of this district used to be Representative Dave Obie's district for a long time. The lines moved and it went from longtime Democratic to pretty reliably Republican. But are Democrats hopeful there?
They really are. So there are a number of Democrats lining up for this seat, kind of in contrast to that 5th congressional district seat. Some of the names out there for this race include State Senator Janet Buley. She's been in the state Senate for a while. A Wausau Democratic activist, Christine Mookley. A Wausau surgeon by the name of Riveron. So there are more certainly Democratic candidates kind of swirling around in the conversation for that race.
So those are the big two. And, of course, there will be a special election and then there will be another election in the normal November elections in 2020, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So this is a really kind of unique situation. And I guess depending on how much you like campaigning, a challenge or a treat for the people participating in this race.
Woo-hoo.
So you would have to win a special election and then a general.
As of now, we have incumbents in all the other seats. Nobody else has said that they're stepping down or not running again yet. Any of those races that you're watching particularly and people stepping up to run against those incumbents?
You know, we haven't really heard anything yet in those other races. I think these two Republican retirement and resignation, respectively, have been taking up kind of a lot of political oxygen in the conversation about Wisconsin congressional races. I think to the extent that Sensenbrenner was expected just because of kind of his tenure and experience, Duffy was a real surprise for Wisconsin Republicans as somebody that, is stepping down at this stage in his career. I think people thought he was going to be around for quite a while. So the conversations have really been focused on the 5th and the 7th. And as we talked about, Democrats are looking at the 7th district in a way that's a little bit unique this time around, hoping that they can flip it back to maybe the time when Dave Obie, a Democrat, represented that district for several decades.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. She joined us for a look at who's in and out in Wisconsin's congressional races. Two of them in particular. Toward the end of August, Republican U.S. Representative Sean Duffy announced he would resign from his 7th District seat. That'll happen this coming Monday, if I'm doing the math right. Early this month, longtime Republican Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner said he would not seek re-election in the 5th District next year, leading to at least so far two open seats in Wisconsin's congressional delegation and one special election next year. A lot to keep track of. Here's a listing on Airbnb for you. If you're not into Airbnb, it's an online place where building owners rent out their space online. It's turned into a pretty big business. Anyhow, here's that listing. Two guests, one bedroom, one bed, one private bathroom. What's that? Not too interesting? Well, this listing gets more specific. Prospective renters must be fans of the TV show Downton Abbey. The property is 100,000 square feet. It has a total of 300 rooms. It's situated on a property of 1,000 acres. Okay, if you hadn't guessed, it's the actual Downton Abbey Castle. The real-life Lord and Lady Carnarvon are the owners of Highclere Castle, and that's the castle that plays Downton Abbey on the TV show and the new movie. They're inviting Airbnb applications for one night only. That night is November 26th. Don't try to book it yet. It's going to open up starting October 1st, but it's not just a normal rental. You actually have to make a case for it, and you have to establish that you do appreciate the TV show that you might have seen a lot on public TV. Is it going to be a good stay? I don't know. There's no reviews yet on Airbnb, so I don't know if it's a quality establishment or not, or if they expect you. I don't know if you're playing the role of the like lords and ladies, or like you're one of the servants on the TV show. That's not really clear to me. Also, I think the price was something on the order of £150. I didn't check the math. That's somewhere between $1 and $1,000. I don't really know. You'll have to check me on that. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.